chief of staff.
Walking into earnestness. Well, my friends, there is one difference between now and then. That is, I'm here and not there. But in all candor, I must tell you that I don't think Judge Bork has changed. I like he's, the circumstances have changed. The Senate's changed a little, but that's what I was going to talk about a little bit, is Bork, if you don't mind. First, want to pay my respects to you, all of you. Ken Cribb told me of your meeting here and the importance of it, and I am happy to be part of this program. I'm happy for a lot of reasons. One, I have things I'd like to say about Judge Bork, and that I'd like to say about you, but I really also want you to know that I have a special kinship for this group. And it's for this reason. I had a father-in-law who was a United States Senator and was Minority Leader. I had a father who was a member of the House of Representatives of the United States Congress, and a mother who was a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. So I come from a real political family, but it is not generally known that my grandmother was sheriff of Rome County, Tennessee. And I just wanted you to know that. You think I'm kidding, but it's absolutely true. Incidentally, she lived to be 102 and died of boredom. She was a great lady. She followed her husband as sheriff of Rome County, Tennessee. And I'll tell you one other little story and then get on with the matter at hand. In 1980, when I was running for the Republican presidential nomination, I must tell you that because unless you play Trivial Pursuit, you would not remember that I ran for president in 1980. But in 1980, one of my staff came to me and said, "This is your grandmother's 100th birthday, and don't you think you ought to leave the campaign trail and go back and have something in her honor?" And with a considerable load of guilt, I said, "Of course I should," and I did, and had a reception, and there were hundreds of people. There may have been 1,000 people who came through, and there was a receiving line, and she and I stood there together and shook every hand, and I was worn out, and she was still going strong. When the line finally slacked off and we had a private moment together, just the two of us. And we sat down and she looked at me with that stern grandmotherly look and says, "Howard, are you serious about running for president?" I said, "Of course I'm serious." She says, "Good, then I'll support you." She said, "But if you want to really get close to power in this country, run for sheriff. That's where the power is really at." And I thought you ought to know that, and to know that I've been raised in a tradition of great respect for the law enforcement officials of this country, both by filial affection and by genuine respect for what you do. But as I say, before the president arrives, I'd like to take this opportunity to pay my respects to him for a moment, not just because I work for him. He is my only constituent these days. But also because I have a genuine personal relationship with him that I treasure. And even though I've known him for a long time, I've never come to have the enormous, extraordinary respect for his acumen, for his convictions, for his commitment to principle that I have now and have continued to develop since he came to the presidency. And he does. He has what I call a central core of conviction. Very straightforward in what he believes, and he believes what he believes. And, you know, I'll tick him off just for a second. He believes that the United States ought to be strong militarily, and he's set about a successful program of saying that we are. Incidentally, we would not have meaningful arms control talks going on now if he hadn't done that, because he made America worth negotiating with. He believes that the country is overgoverned, overtaxed, and overregulated, and he's got a long, long way toward lifting that yoke, letting the American people have more freedom and more independence and more say about what happens with their own resources in the countries. And most people said that couldn't be done, but it has been done. And he believes that we are a nation under God of laws and not of men. And that's not unique. Politicians say that all the time, but Ronald Reagan means it and exhibits it in everything he does, and particularly in the choices he makes for the federal judiciary. It may be that presidents will best be known, absent historic circumstances, for the quality of the people they pick for the federal judiciary, for the Supreme Court, and the other courts of the land. And that's one of the reasons why I think that Judge Bob Bork's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court is so important. I know that you in the criminal justice field share the president's commitment to appointing only judges that faithfully apply law and precedent to the cases that come before them. And during his years on the bench, Robert Bork has shown that he shares your commitment and the president's commitment. Any one of Judge Bork's four positions in private practice and academia, in the executive branch or the judiciary, would have been the high point of a brilliant career. But he's managed all of those things. He was a professor at Yale for 15 years, holder of two endowed chairs, graduate of the University of Chicago Law School, Phi Beta Kappa, and managing editor of the Law Review. He is among the nation's foremost authorities on constitutional law, antitrust law, and is the author of dozens of scholarly works. He is an experienced practitioner. He was an active partner in the prestigious law firm of Kirkland & Ellis. And my friends, I can tell you from my days in private practice that that is indeed a great firm. I can also tell you that my wife asked me the other day, how come it is that you're happy doing what you're doing and I'm not? I said, what do you mean? She says, how come it is when you have great power, you're broke? And that when you're in private life, we weren't. I said, well, that's a sage observation, but I think I'll just let it lay there. I don't believe I'll reply to it at all. He was Solicitor General of the United States from 1973 through 1977, and his responsibility as Solicitor General, as you know, is to represent the United States of America before the Supreme Court of the United States, which he did on hundreds of occasions. He was unanimously confirmed, as my friend in the front row points out, by the United States Senate for the D.C. Circuit in 1982 after receiving the American Bar Association's highest rating, which is exceptionally well qualified. And that rating, my friends, is given by the ABA only to a small handful of judicial nominees every year, thus signifying that Judge Robert Bork is indeed an extraordinarily qualified person and eminently qualified to carry on his career as a member of the Supreme Court of the United States. He is now and has been an influential member of the D.C. Circuit. He's been able to persuade his colleagues on the merits of his views, witnessed by the fact that he has voted with majority on that court 94% of the time. And in several of those cases in which he dissented, the Supreme Court of the United States subsequently vindicated his dissent and joined in his view rather than the majority view in the court below. His opinions on the Court of Appeals reflect a consistent judicial restraint. He has upheld and enforced liberal laws and agency decisions as often as conservative ones. He defies the effort to be classified as a liberal or a conservative. He is a judge. Judge Bork brings a human dimension to his work. He is a veteran with two stints in the Marines, a firm and devoted family man, a warm, friendly, plain-spoken man who doesn't stand on ceremony. He brings a human, practical perspective to the court. And in the recent words of Justice Stevens of the U.S. Supreme Court, Robert H. Bork will be a welcome addition to the U.S. Supreme Court. I hope each of you will join with the president and support the confirmation of this most able jurist to the highest court of our land. My friends, let me also say that I'm optimistic about Judge Bork's nomination and his ultimate confirmation in the Senate. I've spent a fair amount of time now talking to my former colleagues in the Senate, my friends there who and some who aren't my friends there, about the obvious merit of Judge Bork. And I will will tell you that notwithstanding that he has been warmly applauded by the legal profession and the judiciary since his selection as an associate justice of the Supreme Court, that Judge Bork will be his own best witness. So as the hearings began, be prepared for an extraordinary performance. Robert Bork is absolutely stunningly bright. He will handle himself with great dignity, but also with great effectiveness, I predict, before the Senate Judiciary Committee. I was especially pleased to see the remarks by Senator DeConcini yesterday and Senator Byrd, which suggests that Senator Byrd, who is the majority leader and also a member of the Judiciary Committee, favors the reporting of Judge Bork to the Senate. That does not necessarily signify that Senator Byrd will finally vote for Judge Bork, although I hope he will. But it does suggest that one of the three fights, one of the three hurdles that has to be overcome, that is to see the nomination reported, to see it approved by the Senate, and perhaps to shut down a filibuster, that one of the three appears to be well in sight and at hand. It appears that Judge Bork's nomination will go forward, will be reported by the committee, and reach the floor of the Senate for its full consideration. That's an eminently fair thing for Senator Byrd to say. He need not say that. But I predict that I believe that Senator Byrd is mindful of the fact that even though he is a Democrat and the president is a Republican, that the Constitution doesn't say a thing on earth about the Judiciary Committee giving its advice or consent to the nomination of a member of the Supreme Court, but rather the Senate to do that. So I applaud what Senator Byrd said. I hope it augurs well for future support. I'm optimistic about the judge's prospects, but it requires our help, your help, the help of people who are concerned about law and order and concerned about equity and humanity, to see this fine jurist does take his place on the bench. My friends, if you'll excuse me now, I'll go do what I do very best. I'll go see if the president's here, and if he is, I'll bring him in.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, thank you all very much. Please be seated. It's a pleasure welcoming you to the White House complex, you chiefs of police, state troopers, sheriffs, and other members of the National Law Enforcement Council. And it's quite a difference from my first experience with one of your kind when I was about so high and had some fireworks in the wrong place. And then after my father paid the fine, there were fireworks at home. Well, seeing so many of you reminds me of a story, and you may have heard everything reminds me of a story. This one concerns a fellow who was in a small automobile accident, one of those fender bender types, and he got out, and the other fellow got out of his car, and neither one of them were hurt. But the other fellow said, "Hey, you look a little shaken up. Wait a minute here." And he went back to his car, got a bottle, and handed it to him. He said, "Take a drink of this. It should settle you down." And so the man did. And then he said, "Oh, come on. Take another one. I know you're shaken up." And he did. And three or four drinks later, the fellow said, "Well, wait a minute here. I don't want to drink at all. Do you have a drink?" And he said, "No, I'll just stand here and wait for the police to get here." Well, this year we celebrate the 200th anniversary of the framing of the Constitution. And in the history of nations, ours is a young nation. The nations of Western Europe are older, as are many of the nations of Asia. China is much older, and yet, young as our nation is, we have nevertheless the oldest written constitution in the world. For two centuries, our constitution has secured the blessings of liberty for people from every part of the earth who left behind the lands of their ancestors and came here to live in freedom and to call themselves Americans. I say this to you because you and members of the law enforcement community, like you, have played a special role in our nation ever since its founding. The men who wrote the Constitution said that among their purposes was to establish justice and ensure domestic tranquility. They knew that for this to be a land of liberty, it must also be a land of lawful order. You know, a few years ago, it seemed that some people who should have known better had forgotten the basic truth that law, order, and liberty go hand in hand. Too many courts appeared to regard the serious business of ensuring our domestic peace and protecting our nation's communities against crime as a kind of intricate game that pitted police officers against clever lawyers. And always we heard about the rights of criminals, rarely those of their victims. In the last 7 years, a balance has begun once again to return America's courtrooms. Both federal and state government have tightened their criminal codes. New judges have been appointed to the bench. The result has been longer sentences and a more realistic view by courts on all levels of what it's like for you to go to your duties each morning with the very real life and death warning, be careful out there. I'm proud to report to you that the federal government has taken a lead in bringing about this change. When I first came into office, I promised a massive attack on organized crime, a social evil that had been tolerated too long in our nation. I said we were declaring war on the mob. It's drug peddling, yes, but also its influence in every form of racketeering and its capacity to corrupt business, unions, and public law enforcement officials. When I announced this attack on the mob in 1982, I also announced a wide-ranging series of steps from new preventive and investigative measures to the appointment of a presidential commission on organized crime. Some, of course, were skeptical, but the evidence is now in from all around the country. We're winning, and these are no longer just tactical victories. We have a full-fledged strategic assault underway, and the mob is on the run. Around the country, federal prosecutors are winning convictions against the working heads of organized crime, and the Mafia's National Board of Directors, the infamous commission, has been put behind bars. Meanwhile, drug seizures have reached record levels. Drug arrests have gone up and have included some of the most notorious figures in the drug underworld. 3 years ago, after long stalling, the Congress at last passed the Comprehensive Crime Control Act. The act eliminated parole and reduced the amount of time off for good behavior that could be granted a prisoner. The United States Sentencing Commission was also established, and it has drafted guidelines that make sentences more predictable. The Crime Control Act also included new provisions like rules for confiscating drug assets. I can't tell you what a kick it was for me the first time early on in my term down in Florida, stand in front of a table with $20 million piled up on it, all drug assets that had been confiscated. It's making life harder for drug traffickers and easier for the police, and you can see the results for yourselves. Last year, the average federal prison sentence for a drug offense was almost 40% lower than it was in 1979. The average fraud and weapons possession sentences were more than 40% lower. Overall, federal sentences have averaged more than 30% longer than they had 7 years before. Put another way, in 1979, the average federal sentence for drug dealers was over 50 months. Since then, it's climbed steadily to 70 months, and drug convictions have doubled. Some of you may have been involved in the National Narcotics Border Interdiction System that works under the direction of Vice President Bush. One critically important part of the criminal justice system is the judiciary. Federal judges have also been getting tougher on criminals and the sentencing figures, as they suggest. And I'm told that I've appointed 4 of every 10 judges that are sitting on the bench today. Several weeks ago, I made another nomination to the federal bench, one I'm particularly proud of. I know that you've heard about him already this morning, Robert Bork. I believe that Judge Bork will be an extraordinary addition to the United States Supreme Court. He's already had a remarkable legal career. As a partner in a leading law firm, he was recognized as among the best in his field. As a professor at Yale, he became one of the preeminent legal scholars of our time. And as a judge of the most important appeals court in the country, he has been widely acclaimed for his intellectual power and his fairness. No man in America, and few in history, have been as qualified to sit on the Supreme Court as Robert Bork. Furthermore, in his 5 years on the bench, Judge Bork has demonstrated a clear understanding of the appropriate role of the judiciary in our constitutional system. Many years ago, a great justice, Felix Frankfurter, defined this role when he said, "The highest exercise of judicial duty is to subordinate one's personal pulls and one's private views to the law." This is called the doctrine of judicial restraint. And as Lloyd Cutler, President Carter's White House counsel, recently wrote, I quote, "All justices subscribe at least nominally to this philosophy, but few rigorously observe it." Justices Oliver Wendell Holmes, Louis D. Brandeis, Felix Frankfurter, Potter Stewart, and Louis F. Powell, Jr. were among those few, and Judge Bork's articles and opinions confirm that he would be another. If I could appoint a whole Supreme Court of Felix Frankfurters, I would. And I've taken a step, I think, with Robert Bork. The Supreme Court has shown its own esteem for Robert Bork. Judge Bork has written more than 100 majority opinions and joined in another 300 majority opinions. The Supreme Court has never reversed a single one of these more than 400 opinions. That's a vote of confidence any judge in America would envy. And what's more, 9 of the 10 times the Supreme Court reviewed a case that Judge Bork had ruled on, Justice Powell agreed with Bork. It's hard for a fair-minded person to escape the conclusion that if you want someone with Justice Powell's detachment and statesmanship, you can't do better than Judge Bork. Judge Bork deserves to be evaluated on his merits. He deserves to be considered promptly. Justice Powell has noted that when the court is below full strength, it has an adverse effect on the court's business. I hope the Senate will take note of this concern. One way or another, it should act on Judge Bork's nomination before the court goes into session in October. Each senator must decide which criteria is right for casting this critical vote, qualifications or politics. I hope you'll join me in urging the Senate to confirm Judge Bork. I feel the American people want criminals going to jail while constitutional rights are preserved. So please tell your senators that you will stand by them if they support Judge Bork. I can't think of any better way of marking this 200th anniversary of the framing of our noble Constitution than by placing a justice of Robert Bork's quality on the United States Supreme Court. I just want to tell you to confirm how strongly I feel about you and law enforcement. There's a member of the Secret Service today who was formerly a policeman in San Bernardino, California. And I'll bet, maybe you've heard of the famous diaper case. He and another man, on evidence that indicated that heroin was being sold from a certain residence, had a warrant, went in, searched the residence and couldn't find it. And on the way out, just on a hunch, this fella turned. There was a baby there in the crib. And he took off the baby's diaper. And there was the heroin. The evidence was thrown out of court because the baby hadn't given its right, its constitutional right, to be searched. And that's when he quit being a policeman and came into the Secret Service. But I think we've had enough of diaper cases and that sort of thing in this land, and you ought to be freed of any such disappointments as he had when he came into court with the evidence. So I thank you all, and God bless you all. Thank you.
National Law Enforcement Council. We appreciate your tough posture on crime and your support of this nation's police officers. And on behalf of 40,000 troopers in the nation with the National Troopers Coalition, I want to make you an honorary trooper by presenting you the hat that these members wear, the official Trooper Stetson.
Thank you very much. Thank you, little Robert. I'll try to grow into it.
Also, very good. Also, we have an official trooper shirt from the Maryland State Police that goes with the hat.
Well, thank you all very much.